Ah, mmm. The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
The Art Curious podcast is sponsored by Anchorlight. For more information about all of Anchorlight's artistic and creative endeavors, please visit anchorlightraleigh.com. I've mentioned a few times before on this podcast that I sometimes like the weird and funky side of things, and that really holds true for me when it comes to art history. I mean, come on. There's a reason I call this show Art Curious and not something else like Art Beautiful or whatever. And that was the whole inspiration for these past two seasons, to look at works of art that are strange or shocking or terrifying. But I've got to admit that this fascination for me really only holds true in a format like painting or sculpture. Because if you're showing me something in real life, like a photo of something disastrous or a video of a medical procedure, most of the time, I'm out. It's not for me. I'm not totally squeamish. It's just not my thing. But if you put it on canvas, I want to know more, more, more. That's odd, right? Some people think that visual art is dry, boring, lifeless. But the stories behind those paintings, sculptures, drawings, and photographs are weirder, crazier, or more fun than you can imagine. Today, by popular demand, we are continuing our Season 5 exploration of shock art, where we will be dissecting single works of art that shook their contemporary worlds, covering another painting that caused waves. In this episode, it's time for the wonders of the 19th century American medicine and the Victorian world that wasn't ready for it. We're talking Thomas Aiken's The Gross Clinic. This is the Art Curious podcast, exploring the unexpected, the slightly odd, and the strangely wonderful in art history. I'm Jennifer Dassel. Thomas Aikens was Philadelphia-born and Philly-proud, and as a former resident of Pennsylvania myself, I gotta say, represent. He was born in the city of brotherly love in 1844 and spent most of his formative years learning from the city's prestigious artists and art schools, studying for 4 years at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, the very first art school in the U.S., founded less than 30 years after the American Revolution. As the center of the small but growing art scene in the new country, Philadelphia was it for any American looking to become a true artist. And young Aikens excelled there, attending as many exhibitions and collections as possible while honing his craft. He even took anatomy courses and attended lectures at the Jefferson Medical College nearby, something which, as we're about to see, not only influenced him in terms of being able to render the human figure in great precision, but also would become an important subject for him. Just because Aikens was in the best city in America for studying art at that time didn't mean that it had everything he needed. And so, like many before and after, he really went for it, and he moved to the city most connected to art in the 19th century, Paris. He lived in Paris for a number of years, studying with the famed Orientalist painter Jean-Léon Gérôme at the École des Beaux-Arts, continually improving his technical skill and falling deeply in love with realist modes of art making, the post-revolutionary art movement that rejected overblown emotions and subject matter of the romantics who came before and opted instead to paint scenes of everyday life without sentimentality or too much drama. When Aikens returned home to Pennsylvania at the age of 26, he brought this fascination home with him. He worked consistently, portraying whatever he pleased. Sure, he did the rare commission for a wealthy collector or two, but he mostly completed images of family or friends, and also athletes or those engaging in outdoor activities, which he himself loved. Hunting, fishing, boating, rowing, swimming, and many of these works are part of Aikens' legacy, a big part of what Aikens is remembered for today. Aikens wasn't terribly crazy about doing things that he didn't want to do. But even so, his excitement for one particular project stands out clearly. as H. Barbara Weinberg, curator emerita of American paintings and sculpture at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, once wrote, quote, "In late March 1875, the artist wrote to a friend, saying, 'I feel to myself that I am going to soon do work so much better than anything I have made yet.'" It seems likely that the project sparking Aiken's enthusiasm was the canvas that occupied him for almost a year, the Gross Clinic, unquote. Set in a dimly lit amphitheater, Thomas Aiken's The Gross Clinic depicts the titular doctor, Samuel D. Gross, lecturing a student audience while leading a surgical operation. Silver-haired, stern-faced, and dressed in a three-piece suit, Dr. Gross easily commands the attention of the viewer as he casually rests his hands on the operating table and loosely holds a bloodied scalpel in the other. Surrounding him are his surgical assistants, who attend to the incision made on the patient's left thigh as the doctor lectures to the crowd, and most of them can be identified. There's Dr. Joseph Hearn, an anesthesiologist, sitting at the far end of the table, who covers the patient's head with anesthesia-soaked gauze. Going clockwise from Dr. Hearn is Dr. James Barton, probing the incision with a wooden, stick-like instrument. Next in the bottom right of the painting is a younger surgeon, Dr. Daniel Apple, holding a metal retractor that separates one side of the incision from the other. To Dr. Apple's left is Dr. Charles Briggs, whose hands grip the patient's calves in order to keep them in place during the surgery. Another assistant, this one not identified, is sitting behind Dr. Gross, holding an additional retractor. A scribe identified as Dr. Franklin West sits behind them on a pedestal, recording the surgical process as well as Dr. Gross's words. Aikens himself can be seen to the viewer's far right, sitting in the audience and presumably sketching his observations. As if the words incision and retractor aren't making it obvious, we should note that the scene represented here in the Gross Clinic is rather explicit. Aikens has given the viewer full visual access to the scene, and that includes the gory details of the surgery taking place. Bloody instruments, bloody hands, a gaping wound. It's not like a horror film by any circumstance, but to those who might be squeamish, it's clear that the title of this painting could very well serve a double meaning. But for most of the individuals presented in the scene, it's no big deal. Perhaps just another day at med school under the tutelage of Dr. Gross. But while the students look down at the operation with relaxed, perhaps even bored expressions, there is one figure sitting closer to the foreground who cannot bear to watch. Shielded by the figure's left arm, this person's face is turned away, clearly repulsed or terrified by the scene, or both. Art historians have often identified this figure as the patient's mother, a woman decked in black and obviously not doing very well under the circumstances. We'll come back to this lady a bit later. But for now, let's move on. The story of how the Gross Clinic came about is an interesting one. The work was created with a single event in mind, the 1876 Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia, formerly called the International Exhibition of Arts, Manufactures, and Products of the Soil and Mine, and less formally called the Centennial. This fair aimed to showcase the economic and technological progress that had been made in America since the Civil War, while also celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. It was the first of many so-called World's Fairs that was held on American soil, and it sought to prove that the accomplishments and advancements made in the United States were on par with those made in Europe at the time. Throughout the fair's long duration, over 9 million visitors would end up visiting to demonstrate their patriotism and to celebrate a post-Civil War nation. And though Thomas Aikens obviously could not know the extent of the popularity of the Centennial, he and the organizers and the general public alike knew that it was a big deal, and Aikens wanted to get in on that action. And he had what he thought would be the perfect addition to the fair. As a Philadelphia native, Aikens was eager to present the Gross Clinic at the Centennial, for nationally renowned Dr. Gross also hailed from the city of brotherly love and taught at nearby Jefferson Medical College. This was Aikens' opportunity to not only honor Dr. Gross and his accomplishments to the medical field at large, but also to express pride in the city he called home. And it didn't hurt that the work of art could be a virtuoso scene that would show Aiken's skill at portraiture, anatomy, and dramatic genre scenes, all while doing so on a monumental scale of more than 7 feet high and more than 6 feet across. The Gross Clinic, his new masterpiece, seemed ready-made for the fair, and full of hope and pride, he presented it to the committee for selection at the Centennial. You can probably imagine what happened next. And that's coming right up after this break.
Thank you. I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Great art has the power to shed light on how people live, what they value, and what they can teach us. And as listeners to the show, I know that you love learning about all of this as much as I do. That's why I know you'll also enjoy The Great Courses. I am a big fan of The Great Courses, which have these incredible in-depth digital video courses from top experts who are not only extremely knowledgeable, but super fun to listen to and so passionate about their subjects. I have recently been binging their series called Museum Masterpieces, The Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I love this course because if you have been to the Met, it's like visiting and being able to enjoy your favorite galleries from the comfort of your own home. Over the course of 24 lectures, this course will take you through the Met from top to bottom. You get to see everything from ancient Greek and Roman works of art to Rembrandt, Van Gogh, African art, and so much more. And it's all presented with so much enjoyment and enthusiasm by Professor Richard Betrel. This digital video series is exclusively available through The Great Courses. And once you buy, you get to keep it forever to watch it anytime, anywhere. I know you will get so much out of Museum Masterpieces, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So The Great Courses is giving my art curious listeners this exclusive, very limited time offer. Order this digital video course right now and get 85% off the regular price. That's over $185 in savings. And you can start watching it instantly. But this fantastic deal is only available for a very limited time and only by going to my special URL. So don't wait. Go to thegreatcourses.com/art. That's thegreatcourses.com/art. Life can get really crazy sometimes. Between my busy young family, a full-time museum job, this podcast, and a few little fun side projects, and oh yeah, having a life, it's like I sometimes need to remind myself to take a breath. Modern life isn't simple, but a modern home can be. That's why I am so excited about All Modern. All Modern is an online-only destination for everything modern, everything from mid-century to Scandinavian to minimalist. But they are priced for real life, not for designers or for those with deep pockets. It's seriously simple, too. You can shop from home or on the go, find that sofa you saw on Instagram but for way less, and get it fast. All furniture ships for free, and most in just 2 days, not 6 to 8 weeks like all those other stores. And All Modern even offers in-room delivery and assembly. I've been living with the same sofa for almost 20 years now, and I am way overdue for a fresh upgrade. So I've been using All Modern to keep my eyes on some pretty luxurious tufted sofas that will look so chic in my house. And best of all, their prices don't make me want to cry. New beautiful furniture is in my reach, and it can be in yours too. So go to allmodern.com/artcurious and use the promo code ARTCURIOUS for 10% off your first purchase. Again, that's allmodern.com/artcurious, then use promo code ARTCURIOUS. All Modern, the style you love, the prices you want, when you want it. It's that simple. The world's best designers know that the secret to creating an unforgettable space is Sora Lighting. Sora Radiant LED is uniquely designed with full-spectrum technology so that you can see each and every color as nature truly intended it. So if you've ever walked into a great museum and wished that your home could look as vibrant, the answer could be in changing your light. Art curators and designers in the world's best museums know that Sora Radiant LED shows art with the full range of color and makes it look its very best. Because most LED bulbs have color gaps and they leave your space looking washed out and artificial. And for someone like me who really likes to have everything look beautiful in her home and in her work life, Sora is really ideal for me. I love how it really changes and affects the way I see my surroundings. And plus, it really helps that the bulbs are dimmable so that I can control my lighting and make my house feel exactly how I want it to feel. Sora Radiant is the only LED designed with full spectrum color technology to eliminate those color gaps, and it makes colors and skin tones look vibrant and real, the same as if you were in natural sunlight. Radiant doesn't buzz when you dim it, and it won't leave you with headaches. And they are all energy efficient, using just a fraction of the energy of incandescent bulbs, and it will last 10 times as long. So change your light and make your space look its best and most natural with Sora Radiant. For 15% off any purchase over $50, visit amazon.com/Sora. That's amazon.com/SORAA and enter promo code ARTCURIOUS at checkout. Welcome back to Art Curious. Due primarily to its subject matter, the Centennial Committee decided against showing the Gross Clinic at the Centennial's art exhibition, and its rejection was a serious blow to Thomas Aikens. But he was bound and determined to have the work seen anywhere that it could be, and so he scrambled for an exhibition space. For a year and a half, throughout the long run of the fair, it hung in a room designated for holding medical supplies, and it was seen by few and actually appreciated by fewer. Still, one art critic gave the artist high praise and felt that it was unfortunate that the painting had been relegated to a mere wall in a hospital wing, writing, quote, "There is nothing so fine in the American section of the art department of the exhibition, and it is with great pity that the squeamishness of the selection committee compelled the artist to find a place in the United States hospital building," unquote. The same critic noted with disdain that even the American art that had been accepted by the Centennial was scarcely discussed in the press. Art just wasn't the big deal at the fair, and what a disappointment and a lack of foresight of our young country that they didn't consider it more integral. After nearly 2 years of languishing behind scalpels and retractors at the Army Hospital, the Gross Clinic was acquired by the Jefferson Medical College, which makes perfect sense, since Dr. Gross himself both attended the college and sat as the co-chair of the Department of Surgery there. For the realistic rendition of their nationally famed and locally loved doctor, the school was grateful. And thus, they were willing to work with Thomas Aikens to have the work seen and shown elsewhere. So in 1879, Aikens borrowed the painting back and exhibited it at the Kurtz Gallery in New York, with hopes that the passage of 4 years and in an entirely different city, both the artist and his hometown would finally begin to attract the attention of the press. And that it did, almost immediately. The phrases decidedly unpleasant, wholly hostile, and dreadful were just a few of the scathing words used to describe Aikens' work. Like the exhibition committee of the Centennial a few years prior, these new viewers were appalled and horrified by the sight of fresh blood oozing onto the surgeon's hands. And I have never been so grateful for the invention of latex gloves as I am when I am viewing this work, by the by. They were disgusted by the cold metal tools prying open what an author from the New York Tribune described as a, quote, "long and shapeless lump of flesh," unquote. It wasn't all bad, of course. Aikens is a skilled portraitist, and the detail of each and every figure, even the less visible or the blurred students in the operating theater, is bonkers good. Dr. Gross was a real-life person, and he looks it. The observational skills and preparations needed to make this work come to fruition were stunning, and the art critics, at the very least, were laudatory in this case. But there was something besides the blood that they didn't like at all. The artist's decision to include the patient's mother in the scene. First of all, critics noted that in an otherwise scientifically realistic scene, the inclusion of a mother watching her son's surgery so closely would not only be unrealistic, but it would be outright cruel. Similarly, her disgust, many reviewers felt, needed not be part of an already gruesome scene. I can't say for sure if the patient's mother really was in the operating theater when Aikens witnessed and sketched the scene, but she probably wasn't. So did Aikens need to include her just to ratchet up the drama? I guess. But it's not like it needed it. Even the depiction of the patient's bare thigh, let alone the blood, was deemed a step too far, with some calling it improper for an artist to portray the body as explicitly uncovered, laid bare, laid open, literally. To this, I've got to say, well, okay, but how else would you expect someone to undergo a surgery? Whatever, I'm not a doctor. Suffice to say, people didn't like what was being presented to them. Even the New York Times got in on the action, critiquing Akins by noting, quote, "This violent and bloody scene shows at the time that it was painted, if not now, that the artist has no conception of where to stop, or how to hint a horrible thing if it must be said, or what the limits are between beauty of the nude and the indecency of the naked," unquote. Thomas Akins had hoped to show the painting in New York City, a town seen as more cultured and advanced as far as art acceptance was concerned. But he found as little support there as he did back home in Philadelphia. To paint such a ghastly scene and dare call it art was seen as a ludicrous claim, and in both locations, Akins' reputation was growing more and more tarnished with every negative review. All this negativity, though, does make me wonder if it all even ever really mattered. Two axioms come to mind when I think of this work. The first is that old news adage, if it bleeds, it leads, meaning that the more terrible or violent a crime or subject matter, the more attention will be spent on it in the press. The second is that no publicity is bad publicity. So even if Akins' work wasn't getting love left and right from the general public or the art critics, it was, at the very least, being discussed, and obviously discussed heavily. And if they're talking about you, that means you're making an impact. Certainly, I don't think that Thomas Akins painted the gross clinic as an attention grab, upping the gore factor simply to get tongues wagging. But it's nevertheless a reminder that all of these shocking works of art that we're talking about this season and last season on the Art Curious podcast, there's a reason that we're still talking about them. They got attention, good or bad, and a lot of times they got it for this shock value. And that still means something, even today, when any number of cable TV shows or video games featuring far more violence and blood seem to have far less of an impact. The Gross Clinic might not look like a big deal from our current perspective, but that's one of the things that's so interesting about it. To see how far we've come, how times have changed, how a single painting can no longer necessarily disgust or horrify. After living its life at the Jefferson Medical College until 2006, the Gross Clinic is now a part of the Philadelphia Museum of Art's permanent collection, along with Akins' studies of Dr. Gross and Dr. Barton's heads and other preliminary sketches made for the final work, all which provide really nice context to the development of the final piece itself. Although the value of this work has been fully realized by modern-day historians, its controversial past is truly what makes it all the more compelling. It is remarkable to think that a painting that was once too unbearable for the public is now called, by many, the greatest American painting of all time. Next time on the Art Curious podcast, it's a revolution of a different sort. This time, the French Revolution, and the shocking portrait of a revolutionary hero, or is he a reviled man? Thank you for listening to the Art Curious podcast. This episode was written, produced, and narrated by me, Jennifer Dassel, with additional writing and research help by Adria Gunter. Our theme music is by Alex Davis at alexdavismusic.com. Our logo is by Dave Rainey at daverainedesign.com. And social media help is by Emily Crockett and Sammy T. Our production and editorial services are provided by Kabunki. Video, content, ideas. Learn more at kabonki.com. Additional editing help is by Hannah Roberts. The Art Curious podcast is sponsored primarily by Anchorlight. Anchorlight is a creative space founded with the intent of fostering artists, designers, and craftspeople at varying stages of their development. Home to artist studios, residency opportunities, and exhibition space, Anchorlight encourages mentorship and the cross-pollination of skills among creatives in the Triangle. For more information, please visit anchorlightraleigh.com. The Art Curious podcast is also fiscally sponsored by VAE Raleigh, a 501c3 nonprofit creativity incubator. For more details on our show, including the image mentioned in today's episode, please visit our website, artcuriouspodcast.com. You can also find details there on how to hire me for an event at your university, art center, or elsewhere. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Art Curious Pod. Check back in 2 weeks as we continue to explore the unexpected, the slightly odd, and the strangely wonderful in these shocking works of art history.
Thank you.